Hello and welcome again to Sport Unlocked. It's the holidays, but the pods keep coming to keep you comprehensively updated on the sports news issues of the week. And we'll be hearing from the African football chief. Patrice Motsepe is insisting the African Cup of Nations will start as planned in January. And he's been hitting back at critics, particularly in Europe, trying to thwart the tournament going ahead in Cameroon. We've also got Gianni Infantino making the financial case for biennial World Cups after FAs were told this week that an extra €4 billion could be generated every 4 years if they approve the plans. One man who works with sponsors isn't convinced, and Steve Martin, the global CEO of M&C Saatchi Sports of Entertainment, will be joining us. The growth area in sports sponsorship seems to be in cryptocurrency and fan tokens. In the week, Arsenal were rebuked by Britain's advertising watchdog over their partnership with Socios. We'll get the view from the Arsenal Supporters Trust. It's a packed festive show to keep you busy on all those walks and runs. And joining me, Rob Harris from the Associated Press as ever, is Tarek Panja from the New York Times and Martin Ziegler from the Times. In the week when we've had more COVID worries in England and Premier League games being postponed, Martin.
Yeah, the COVID pandemic is causing more headlines, of course. And then there's obviously been a sort of flurry of activity around FIFA. Plenty to talk about.
We should probably kick off with the next looming big event, which has had so many question marks on it, the African Cup of Nations starting at the start of January in Cameroon. And CAF officials have been back and forth in meetings in Doha after the FIFA Arab Cup and then in Cameroon with the government and indeed the new Cameroon FA president, Samuel Eto'o. But certainly at the time of recording, it looks like AFCON is on.
Yeah, and if you speak to people in Africa and people around African football, they were really frustrated because they felt all the noise was coming from outside trying to destabilize their event. Yeah, you know, of course, there's a pandemic and a lot of events are at risk and have been at risk because of them. But we've had an Olympic Games, we've had a European Football Championship, and the people in Cameroon are determined to stage this and say they can do it in a biosecure way. And I'm feeling some of the noise around this was for expediency, particularly from European clubs who risk losing players. This is a tournament they've been looking forward to in the region for a long time. And if they can hold it safely, I don't see any reason why they can't or shouldn't be allowed to.
Yeah, any excuse, I think, to try and for European clubs not to release their players, I think they'll that's the sort of hidden message here. Interesting, the CAF executive board met in Qatar, in Doha, which is obviously not within the African continent. Probably linked to the fact that Gianni Infantino was there, do you think?
Yeah, Gianni Infantino was there, and also we saw sort of live tweeting every game was the FIFA Secretary General, Fatma Samoura, live tweeting every game. Not long ago, she was the high governess, I think that was the title, of CAF. When FIFA took over briefly, so there are close connections. Some people now describe CAF as almost a wholly owned subsidiary of FIFA. The Secretary General there now is a former FIFA man, a former ally of Gianni Infantino from UEFA, Veron Musenga.
And the Confederation of African Football president is Patrice Motsepe, and he's been in Cameroon this week, touring facilities and expressing certainty that the tournament will begin on January the 9th in Cameroon.
So come January 9th, they must kick off. So, but it's also important, we have to believe in our people. We have to stop being the ones that lack confidence and are always expressing skeptical, negative views of our own people. All over the world, there are competitions where there are challenges, and sometimes people get 95%. We have to be more optimistic. And sometimes we are over-critical of ourselves. If we are not going to have confidence in our people, who's going to have confidence in our people? So I'm confident, I'm excited. This is the generation where Africans must believe in Africans. We can host a football competition that's as good as you can see in Europe and in the world.
There have been concerns about coronavirus protocols in Cameroon. There's been only 100 or so thousand cases recorded of coronavirus throughout the entire pandemic there. Probably points to less testing, but I think it is developing to be a AFCON taking place virtually behind closed doors, because if every fan has to have a vaccination proof as well as a negative test, and I think fewer than 4% of Cameroon itself has actually been fully vaccinated.
Yeah, not sure quite how that one's gonna work out, unless it's a sort of the sort of thing we saw at the Euros, where they only did spot checks of people's vaccination or COVID passports, and in fact, most people could just get in anyway.
We've got the European Club Association and the World League's Forum expressing doubts about the health protocols being put in place in Cameroon. But perhaps the bigger issue now is the World League's Forum saying that players should not be released to link up with their countries until January the 3rd. That's a week later than the date stipulated by FIFA, only 6 days before the tournament begins. Of course, it would allow particularly the players due to go to AFCON from the Premier League to feature in another two matches over the packed festive programme. And the World League's Forum letter, which was sent on Thursday ahead of Christmas to CAF, talks about the huge impact on domestic competition's integrity, placing many clubs and players in a difficult position. And it's warning FIFA not to punish clubs that don't release their players at the date they are demanding. They say it would be unreasonable and disproportionate for many clubs and players who are still playing at that time to have to go in December, and they're considering that any potential punishments by FIFA would be deemed abusive, null and void. And I think one thing in particular that has struck CAF officials and has gone down very badly with them is the tone of this discussion, and the World League's Forum telling CAF that players are being released for the national teams for free while clubs are paying their salaries. And their letter said, "This makes it possible for CAF to generate revenues and commercialise all rights into the AFCON to fully invest in the development of African football." The letter goes on to say that this makes it possible for CAF to generate revenues and commercialise all rights into AFCON and to fully invest in the development of African football. They say, "Our clubs gladly commit to this solidarity scheme, but in consideration, we expect decisions not to be made in isolation by FIFA and CAF." So it's going to be very hard to see how CAF do back down, given the demands being made of them. And of course, the CAF officials were in Doha with the FIFA hierarchy as well for the Arab Cup, and they did hold meetings out there. And of course, this was an Arab Cup that actually also did feature countries from North Africa,
which was won by Algeria to scenes of mass hysteria from Paris to Algiers, and including the diaspora there in the Gulf as well. That tournament enjoyed some pretty large crowds, a World Cup warm-up test for these new venues. It seemed to have gone off quite successfully, but it seems there has been a rise in COVID cases in Qatar. Qatar has hosted other events recently as well, the Grand Prix and the Arab Cup and a couple of other cultural events.
Well, after the Arab Cup final, the FIFA executives did stick around Qatar because they decided to hold another meeting with its members over biennial World Cups. This should have been the decision time. They hoped for a vote initially around this time on getting the big Infantino plan through, but it was downgraded to a FIFA global summit. And the one thing that struck me from this conference was, for months and months, FIFA have been telling us it's about the best for football. It's what footballers want. It's the best for fans to be having a World Cup every 2 years and for fewer international breaks. It's not about the money. We're not doing it for financial reasons. And what happens this week? It becomes about the money. They start to tout all sorts of numbers around about how many billions more dollars FIFA and the football world is going to earn from biennial World Cup. So ultimately, the financial reasons are one of the significant ones, it turns out.
Yeah, of course, FIFA want more money, this, of course,
as we thought all along.
That's the sort of the whole raison d'etre about this whole process. Whether they're going to accept something a bit less than the biennial World Cup, as we've talked about before, I think is still very strong. I have to say, I take these financial predictions produced by so-called independent agencies or companies with a pinch of salt, because we've had an independent report from UEFA and an independent report from European League saying it would be a financial disaster if the biennial World Cup goes ahead. And we've had an independent report produced for FIFA saying it'll be a financial triumph. So, I mean, it can't be both, can it? So, yeah, I think, I'm slightly, more than slightly cynical about these independent reports.
And the research this time came from the market research firm Nielsen and the Open Economics Organization. And what they found is, rather than the $7 billion currently generated by FIFA every 4 years in the World Cup cycles, they'd get an extra $4.4 billion, apparently. And the 211 member associations that currently get $6 billion could get up to $25 billion every 4 years. Here is the FIFA president, Gianni Infantino, touting those financial advantages of playing the World Cup. Effectively, it would become every year because they'd alternate men's and women's.
In a 16-year period, the reforms would generate a GDP injection of $180 billion. This is about half of the GDP of Denmark, for example, to take only one country, which I think is a reasonably wealthy country. 2 million full-time jobs will be created, 5 billion tax payments for governments. The bottom line is obviously more money for all, maybe in bracket you could say, especially for those that need it most. Zero for FIFA, 100% for solidarity. And this is also important. A second World Cup would generate 4.4 billion more, you heard it. We would set up a $3.5 billion solidarity fund for member associations in a 4-year cycle, which, if what Nielsen projects is right, which is that from the international match calendar there will be no losses, on the contrary, benefits for member associations, all these $3.5 billion would go directly to you, meaning an increase on solidarity from 6 million today to 25 million in a 4-year period on average.
So for a sports marketing perspective now, let's turn to Steve Martin, global CEO of M&C Saatchi Sport and Entertainment. Steve, welcome to Sport Unlocked.
Hey Rob, how are you?
Oh, well, thanks. Well, FIFA are talking about biennial World Cups, many more billions potentially. A dream for sports marketing firms, surely, or are you a bit more hesitant about some of these numbers?
I am a bit more hesitant, I have to say, Rob, because I think they've led with the story on the numbers and the dollars, which is a pretty odd way to lead a story around this, because it's, you know, there are multiple issues. I mean, there's tenfold the issues that they're talking about recommending a World Cup every 2 years. You know, they haven't really talked to the fans. I think they've said they've gone out and, you know, they've surveyed 100,000 fans and they were all really interested in it because it's all, this is what the youth are demanding. I frankly don't believe that at all. I think you're in a big danger here of diluting what a World Cup is all about. You know, it is the most prestigious pro sporting event in the world up there, obviously alongside the Olympics. And the more you play and the more tournaments that happen, they all will dilute that. And you're also, it's also quite clear this is a sort of a fight really and a land grab by FIFA to take revenue away from UEFA. I mean, it's so obvious, given that UEFA control really what FIFA would love, which is the Champions League, and the, you know, the huge success of the likes of Euros, which we've just seen, you know, massive commercial successes. But it also, the biggest thing for me is, it really is sort of cannibalizing all the work they've done on the women's side of the game. You know, Women's World Cup is going to be, I think, one of the biggest and best sporting events that we've seen for many, many years. And, you know, it's almost, they're going to hijack that as well. So there are so many issues, never mind player welfare, never mind commercial pressures from sponsors as well, because they can't put, you know, all their big bets on everything, particularly when you've got all these other events. And then you've got the Olympics alongside it. So it's a funny one to lead on, money first, when actually I think that from a pure fans perspective, never mind a sports marketing perspective, is I think it takes away from it and it really dilutes it. And maybe, you know, that 4-year cycle has always been an exciting build up with all the, you know, all the qualifiers and all the rest of it. And it's felt so amazing to qualify for World Cup. I think that will all be negated a bit as well.
FIFA would say they've introduced this new structure in terms of selling the women's rights separately, which they announced in the last week or so. But as you're saying, does increasing the frequency of the World Cups actually give such a limited window for those sponsors to use their marketing rights that they're actually gaining?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, it all rolls into one and there's no gaps in between. And it just feels like one big blanket of more and more football. I mean, you've seen with cricket. Cricket's been an example of a sport that's too much cricket played. You know, cricket used to be a summer game. Okay, northern and southern hemispheres, but cricket's just an annual game now, right across, and there's too much cricket. And you see that with the audiences and, you know, commercial side of the game and the broadcast nature, it's all over the place. You know, there's some great parts of it, but there's other parts that are so all over the place. And I think the danger, if you play with the crown jewels here, which is the World Cup, you're just going to almost have a combat going on between the bigger governing bodies again, and you're also not thinking about what the players want, the massive restructure of the whole sort of football calendar. It just feels like they're shooting from the hip a bit, and, you know, obviously using Arsene Wenger to go out and be this sort of Trojan horse ambassador for the whole thing. But when you hear them talk about it, they're all, I'm not sure they believe it themselves. It sort of feels a bit more hollow to me, but it's a tricky one, because I think it's, you can understand, yes, of course it would make money, of course it would have a global audience and all the rest of it. But if I was UEFA, I'd be, you know, really standing up against this and getting the whole sort of player power behind it as well, because it's something that would create such a rift in the game. And, you know, a rift with, you know, every part of the game. And I really think fans would stand up and say, no, this is not something we need, because we have the Champions League, and you've got UEFA, all their various competitions, and, as I say, women's side of the game, which is really probably the most exciting new innovation, I would say, if you can call it an innovation. But the fact it's getting proper daylight and proper support and is probably the most exciting parts of the sports industry in the last few years, is the rise of women's sport. And why would they try and again dilute that?
You work with a lot of the sponsors of the World Cups and the Olympics. Is this something that's been a big talking point throughout the last few months as FIFA have been pushing these biennial World Cup plans?
From a sponsor point of view, you have to put, plan and put your big bets on certain things. A World Cup will always be the biggest bet, because you save the money up and you create a sort of a war chest, if you like, from a brand perspective to really market around a World Cup. And that builds up over time. That isn't sort of just, oh, the World Cup's arriving, let's do a bit of marketing a few days before. It builds up over sometimes 12 months before. So you can't do that if you're suddenly having a tournament. It's almost like a tournament every year, which is the way it would play out, the way the football calendar would look like. And, sponsors and brands can't just suddenly spend that sort of money each and every year. It just wouldn't make sense. So I think from that point of view, again, it changes all that dynamic. And I think from a broader sponsorship platform, a World Cup would work. There would obviously be so many brands, because there's so many new brands coming into the world of sport, as we've seen with crypto, et cetera, et cetera. They're not going to be shy getting brands, and don't think they'll struggle. However, their partners that exist at the moment, I would say they'll be very wary, because they wouldn't be able to do the job they normally do around that 4-year cycle.
Excellent. Steve, thanks for joining us on Sport Unlocked.
Thanks, Rob, and very Merry Christmas to you all.
Well, Steve Martin isn't convinced, and he works with some of the biggest sponsors of sporting events around the world. Tariq, what did you make of this FIFA Global Summit? Were you in any way convinced by the financial projections put forward by Gianni Infantino?
It was billed as a very important meeting, a global summit, no less, where they're going to debate the future of football. And what was really unfortunate, I know it's hard to get the whole world together, but the fact that at least two of the members had fallen asleep during Gianni Infantino's vital presentation. Maybe they perked up when he discussed that they're going to get $3 million more each from 6 million to 9 million over a four-year cycle. But it made me think about the decision-making process. Are these the people that should decide on the future of football, just these FA heads, when so much is at stake?
And you actually put that point, didn't you, to Gianni Infantino in the press conference afterwards, and he did sidestep that part of the question.
Look, this is such an important issue, and your summit today was extremely important. It was a bit sad to see at least two members fall asleep during the presentations today. You know, are these the right people, these 211 FAs? Is this the right decision-making mechanism for such a fundamental change to football? Or should other stakeholders be involved? That's my first one. And the second one, as we're talking about these major changes, and these would be, why are we not talking about the distribution of FIFA's money? Each member association I saw will get 9 million instead of 6 through these additional revenues. Is this the right way? Each member gets this huge amount of money. Guam gets the same as Congo. England gets the same as, you know, Guadeloupe. Is this the way? Why are we not talking about where FIFA's money is going?
Thanks, Tariq. Well, I think that we have to, you know, follow a little bit the rule of law, in the sense that we have statutes, and these statutes say that the supreme organ of FIFA is the Congress. It's the 211 member associations, and they have the responsibility to take decisions which will affect, of course, the future of football. How would you otherwise determine through a self-appointed group of, I don't know, people or clubs or leagues or who should decide these things? I think we have to be inclusive. We have to bring everyone on board. We have to listen to everyone. And ultimately, the supreme organ of FIFA is the Congress. But as I was saying already in the past, I hope that we can go to the Congress and to our members with a proposal that everyone can live with and everyone can benefit. As for the distribution of FIFA's money, well, there is no other organization today in the world, no other organization today in the world which is so transparent as FIFA in terms of the distribution of the FIFA money.
So the virtual manner of these press conferences with FIFA meant there was no chance for you to get a follow-up into press him to answer the first part of the question, perhaps not wanting to delve into the thorny area of the problems with FIFA democracy, of one member, one vote for all 211 members, however small, however involved they are in the game.
Yeah, and that kind of formed a part to my second question as well, which was, they're talking about these massive reforms to how football will look in the future, but what they weren't talking about is what happens with all this cash distribution. It's just more money for each federation, all getting doled out the same amount, no matter what their needs were. So it's kind of similar to what he did when he was first elected. Gianni Infantino offered four times more than what Sepp Blatter did. And, you know, lo and behold, he's elected FIFA president. Now he's offering them even more money. And of course, they're going to vote for him. And it's just the way this works. And I asked, if you're going to do all of this, why don't you reform the distribution into a more needs-based version of what you do with your money? And I don't mean just the idea of a small place like Guam not needing 9 million. I also mean some of the wealthy countries, they don't need a FIFA handout as much as some of the others. And also, as more money has gone out in football, has anyone measured if any of these countries are actually improving? Because I haven't seen any sign that the more money results in better football in these countries. Why are we not talking about this stuff?
I think basically, Tariq, because more, any sort of scrutiny about where the money's spent is a potential vote loser. So that's why there isn't that sort of scrutiny, I think. I actually tweeted a picture of the man from Guam, the FA chief asleep during the meeting, slumped fairly sort of horizontally. Well, I had sort of thought long and hard about whether I should do it, whether it was unfair. But I just thought, you know, it's 1 a.m. in Guam. It's not too late. I think if I was up at 1 a.m. on an important FIFA meeting, I think I'd manage to stay awake. So I think that I decided to do it in the end. And yeah, lots of people suggesting he should be the new FIFA president.
Well, he had a window to know when this meeting was going to be. It wasn't like the last minute. Hey, can you stay up till 1 o'clock in the morning? You know, on the day this thing had been flagged, he could have had a nap beforehand. Maybe he just wasn't very interested in what Gianni was saying.
He might be more effective as a FIFA president asleep. Certainly couldn't meddle as much. The FIFA accounts do show that there's quite a bit of development cash available for FAs already to access if they put in for the projects. But beyond those set handouts they get, they have to actually account for this money and they actually have to have provable projects. And not all of that cash is released now. So it does obviously lead to the question about why FIFA would even need to generate even more.
Yeah, and they're going to generate even more as well, because there was a line in the feasibility study that was released by FIFA that said, as well as the 3 million extra per FA across the 4 years, there's going to be a $3.5 billion fund that FIFA will administer. I don't know if they've talked to the FIFA council members or the vice presidents of FIFA, but they have already announced it. And that was something Gianni was keen to trumpet during the press conference as well. I don't know if any of this will see the light of day, but it seemed like he just wanted to show a bigger and bigger pot of money that will be available if only people would agree with this plan.
Yeah, at least the one thing you can say about the development money is things have improved slightly since the days of the old gold program under Sepp Blatter, which was administered by Mohammed bin Hammam, where basically countries would apply for the gold program cash and no checks were ever done. And there were loads and loads of incidents where money was handed over to countries, projects were started, and they just sort of disappeared into the jungle or the desert, and nothing actually ever happened.
Pakistan famously, I think, had 7 half-started projects. Not a single one was complete. One of the countries that got the most from the gold program, but it was able to deliver a lot of South Asian votes.
Yeah, all over like Guyana as well. That was, I remember that at the time, that they had very similar sort of thing.
Yeah, FIFA would point to more rigorous processes now. Where do we think the biennial World Cup plan is? Is it drifting towards this eventual compromise of some sort? Infantino not giving up on it at all, despite the fact the opposition exists from South America, from Europe. There's no backing from the North and Central American Confederation, CONCACAF, with Victor Montaliano, previously seen as very close to Infantino and backing everything he does. He's offered no public support for it either. So he's really limited in terms of global support for this, yet Infantino is pressing ahead with the plan.
I think he's got to. I think, you know, from a sort of negotiating position, he's got to do that. Otherwise, it's a complete failure. So, you know, he's got to go push ahead with this and then hope that he can force some sort of compromise out of UEFA and CONMEBOL, or with some sort of backing from CONCACAF and the Asian Football Confederation.
Yeah, we talked about it last week as well, didn't we? We mentioned that the South Americans and Europeans have come up with an idea for perhaps a joint nations league. Again, they are flying the ointment ahead of this FIFA meeting, and it is these two groups set up against each other at the forefront. But yeah, it's telling that Asian Confederation President Sheikh Salman hasn't said much on this either. However, I do think, given the way these FAs and what they're attracted to, I still think if he was to show them all this money and if it was to come to a vote, he might even have the numbers. But again, that would lead to, I really do believe, an Armageddon of sorts with legal challenges and perhaps a breakaway of South America and UEFA and a whole new world organization for football. And perhaps that might not be a bad thing, some people would say. So let's see it go to the vote and see what shakes down at the end of it.
Yeah, I can't see him risking that, Infantino. I actually do think UEFA are pretty serious about this, and South America too.
You don't think he wants to be the man who broke FIFA?
There are issues for the team that Gianni Infantino does support, Inter Milan, champions of Italy. But now they've had the police at their door this week, raiding them over this sprawling, escalating financial scandal in Italian football over misleading accounting, inflation of transfer fees. It's already seen Juventus have the investigators in seizing documents last month. Serie A also embroiled in it. And all this in the week that Inter, along with AC Milan, finally unveiled plans for the new stadium to replace the San Siro. But it does seem that the Italian authorities do have football in their sights over these accounting practices.
Yeah, it's to do with the alleged manipulation of the transfer market, the amount that clubs have been valuing players for in order to make their balance sheets look healthier than they are. We had Juventus raided a few weeks ago. Now we have Inter Milan, the champions of last year. And also, significantly, we've had Fiorentina, American-owned Fiorentina, owned by the billionaire Rocco Commisso, coming up publicly and quite strongly. They've been complaining. They also said, you know, it's kind of unfair that Inter Milan have been allowed to be champions, given that they have not been paying their wages on time, according to Fiorentina. Some other teams have also not been doing that, while others who have been penalised. For example, some teams that have been relegated last season were paying their wages on time. Others that remained in the league didn't. And they say that's not a level playing field. This week, Fiorentina put a statement out saying as much. They'd like to see the independent bodies responsible for administering Serie A carrying out necessary checks, sharing the details, being more transparent about what rules are being enforced when it comes to the team's finances. They're saying there's a lack of consistency that is not ensuring fair competition. And the Fiorentina owner, Rocco Commisso, is not someone who is shy of firing broadsides. When he was in charge of a team in the US, he took the US League to court, took FIFA to court, in fact, about not administering promotion and relegation in the US soccer leagues, which he said is a foundation stone of FIFA. He lost that case. And now he's coming after Serie A and the Italian Football Association for not administering its rules. And I think this is a fight where he seems to be on the right side of, because all he's saying is, can we have some transparency in the rules? Can you stop changing the rules mid-season in terms of how much, what the spending ratio, what the liquidity ratio of teams should be, about whether teams should be allowed to carry unpaid tax balances on their balance sheets throughout the season? All they want is a clear road that each team must travel along. And I think that's not too much to ask.
Yeah, when obviously football operates in such a way where transfer fees can be amortized across the length of deals and there are different accounting practices that can be used to show income. But it does certainly seem one of the hardest things in this case is assessing what the true value of a player is and what a transfer should actually be at legitimate cost. But I think when you weigh up both sides of some of these deals, that's where you can actually build a pattern of conduct, probably by clubs, that can show this, you know, dubious practices. And is particularly problematic for Juventus, who are a listed company and have those obligations to their shareholders too.
From a sporting perspective, it has huge impact. Like, you know, a sporting financial point of view, I mean, like, you get relegated, you're going to have a real heavy burden on your balance sheet playing second division rather than first division. Likewise, if you manage to get to the riches of particularly the Champions League, you know, you're suddenly looking at almost double your revenues. And that would seem an unfair place to be if you haven't been adhering to the same rules that others have. I think this also shows a greater issue about the state of Serie A. To me, it seems like these clubs, some of them might be sitting on debt time bombs. if they keep deferring payments they need to make, either in wages or in tax, they're almost kicking the can down the road to an implosion at a time where people are wondering what whether Serie A will ever get back to the glories that it had in the not so distant past. It's a real worrying time for Italian football.
The thing that might surprise many people is the fact that Inter head into the winter break still top of Serie A. Many did expect that actually this would be a season of struggles, particularly after losing Lukaku and the lack of investment opportunity from Suning trying to withdraw, you know, in terms of their investment.
Well, some would say they didn't lose enough players in order to meet their debt obligations. I think only a strong statement from the league in terms of transparency and showing how Inter Milan is able to continue functioning very well from a sporting point of view, as you say, Rob, at the top of the league, while facing all these financial challenges.
Well, one way of generating revenue is signing sponsorship deals and commercial partnerships, particularly one more recently with the likes of Socios, the fan tokens. And it's something we've talked about quite often on the pod is the role of cryptocurrencies, fan tokens and NFTs intruding into football and sport more widely so much throughout 2021. And this impression of fan engagement that the Socios tokens deliver, well, now has come a ruling against how they're being promoted, and it's come from the UK, from the advertising watchdog, and it's against Arsenal and its partnership with Socios. So who better to turn to than to Tim Payton of the Arsenal Supporters Trust. Tim, welcome to Sport Unlocked.
Thank you for having me.
So what did you make of this ruling, and how concerned are you as a supporters trust about these fan tokens, which are almost trying to sort of reinvent what they see as fan engagement between a club and the supporter base?
Well, we weren't surprised at the ruling. When it was first announced, we said to Arsenal, should you be doing this? Are you doing it in the right way? What about consumer protection? What about looking after supporters? It's all dressed up as fan engagement and a friendly token. You can log into this app they provide, and it's all a gamified experience, and you vote with footballs and everything. But underneath it all, it's a cryptocurrency. You buy this token, this currency called Chiles, which converts tokens completely unregulated, completely outside of the jurisdiction of any form of protection. And as you mentioned, all being sold under the guise of fan engagement.
Obviously, these tokens are with a plethora of clubs in the Premier League and beyond. So we look at the UK, any number of fans from any number of clubs who are associated could have made potentially the same complaint, and the ASA possibly would have come out with the same outcome, because the risks of this currency are not explained in the way the ASA finding has found anywhere, I think, whether it's Man City or other teams.
Yeah, it's creating precedent, and I'm sure that what the clubs use is a template provided to them by Socios, because it all looks very similar what they're doing. And Socios have said they're also sort of interested in the appeal that will take place, because they're creating new law in effect here. What will be particularly interesting to watch is what the clubs decide to do next. Because if I look at the feedback from Arsenal fans and football fans, there is a lot of unhappiness with this proposition. People think it's wrong that football clubs use their popularity, to promote something totally unregulated and highly risked for people who may not know what they're getting into.
Interestingly, Tim, that I just had a look at what the Arsenal fan token value had, how it had changed, and so it's dropped by like 48% since October. So it just shows, actually, you know, you get these tokens, and if fans are sort of persuaded to start buying them and trading them, then they've lost a lot of money already.
There's no underlying asset value to the token. Arsenal have given Socios 6 interactions a year, or 6 engagement opportunities, like I mentioned, the captain's armband, the colour, you know, what song to play in the dressing room when the team have won. They've given 6 of those in a year. So how can the value go up or down? I thought that has a pretty much a fixed value. It's something you can quantify, and you decide whether or not you get involved. So the whole thing looks like a bump and dump. It just looks like an extraordinary way of riding the popularity of cryptocurrency and football at the same time and trying to pull fans in.
Do you know any fans that have actually bought these? Any real fans that you're surrounded by at the ground or from the supporters trust? Or are these some sort of just distant speculators?
Well, I'm searching high and low, but I can't actually find someone who's match going or who I know that supports Arsenal. And I talk to quite a lot of people, as you might imagine. I can't find anyone who's bought them. So are they bought by desk traders of cryptocurrency around the world? I expect that they are.
Yeah, well, I spoke to Alexander Dreyfus, the CEO of this company, and he says you're not really who they're targeting. They're looking, they're saying, you know, Arsenal, all these clubs, they have all these supporters all over the world, and there's a chance for someone far away to be involved. But then I said, well, if you're a guy in, you know, Malaysia or wherever, why do you care what song is played after someone scores the second goal inside a stadium you're not going to visit? It wasn't really able to answer that. And the other question I have is, why does this have to be a tradable thing? Like, if you want to have a fan engagement token, if you like, which I personally don't think you should. I think fans, whether they're match going or at home, spend a lot of money on football and their teams already. But if you do, why don't you just give them a token for $2 to have a vote on these things? Why does it have to be on a sort of floating exchange? And again, that's something no one's been able to answer. Tim, do you have any idea? What does the club say?
Well, the club just look a bit sheepish and suggest it's a commercial partnership and thank you very much for the money. But exactly, why is it tradable? Also, if it's genuine engagement, why can one person own 1,000 set against someone else's one, set against someone who might go to the stadium every game but not own any? It just doesn't fit in this proposition of empowerment or fan engagement. It's clearly using the power of Arsenal to push cryptocurrency product.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. It's the reason why it's on a floating platform is because the socios and Arsenal share the profits from that they make from people buying tokens, isn't it? I mean,
I understand Arsenal get a commission from every trade in this currency, so they actually have a commercial benefit from people trading, from people exposing themselves to risk. And there's another really worrying thing about this platform, which is it doesn't prevent children from going in. So anyone can log in to the Socios app and be a member and have the Arsenal token. There are rules that stop or supposedly stop anyone under 18 from buying the currency and trading, but they're allowed in. They're allowed to normalise themselves through it. Why on earth is there no regulation of cryptocurrencies? How can you have a situation where the Advertising Standards Authority decides that this isn't appropriate, but there isn't the authority that regulates financial products has left these alone? So what are clubs meant to do? Not get involved at all? Get involved and try and do it with their own regulatory processes? The whole thing has got to have government step in, and perhaps the FA or the Premier League as well, with some kind of centralised code of conduct and best practice to ensure that fans are not ripped off.
But isn't there a bigger question about regulation of crypto more generally? I mean, one of the selling points is this thing is completely unregulated, woohoo, but there's massive risks with unregulated markets like this. And in football, with socios, there's been examples of Aston Villa tokens, Man City tokens, Everton tokens going up, spiking in value suddenly, and then dropping like a stone again, where people have made a load of money and disappeared. And it's got nothing to do with what's happening within the football club or football at all. As you mentioned, it sort of looks, at least from the outside, like a pump and dump scenario where sophisticated investors are taking advantage of this larger market pool, which, you know, it carries huge risk. It's really sad, to be honest, to see football being used in this way.
And it can seem that actually football is where we're sort of seeing the face of the problems with cryptocurrencies, because on the tube, across the internet, we see lots of advertising for people to get involved in crypto, but it's through fans actually highlighting the issues with things like Socios that has brought wider attention to the inaction by government and allowing this deregulated area to potentially be leaving a lot of people at risk and maybe not even aware of the risks. Because some people could listen to this conversation, hear the criticism of the ASA and think we're just sort of a bit backward. We're not recognizing the opportunities presented by the future and seeing the future as cryptocurrencies, let alone the environmental cost of them. but it is this lack of regulation and the huge risks, isn't it, surrounding any investments?
It is, but it's such a classic play to move in on the football fan, because the football fan is tribal, is loyal, loves their club, want to engage in opportunities. So it's sort of sneaking under the barrier of people will see the tube for these crypto wallets, that the ads for the crypto wallets on the tube and not be interested will be a bit suspicious. But you get something come along and says, oh, you can be more engaged with Arsenal, and you might go and buy a few. And then you read on this Telegram group that these sophisticated investors run around each token. Oh, it's going up today. You must buy in. And then you can see how suddenly you get a plunge in the price and the pump and dump has been executed. I really hope that Arsenal will look very hard at how they can protect their fans going forward.
What Sosyos are saying in a statement is, we welcome Arsenal's call for an independent review. This is a fast-moving area and clarity is needed to ensure all companies can adhere to the latest guidelines. What Sosyos didn't acknowledge in the answer to me was I made the point that given these fan tokens only give the impression of engagement, but there is actually little in reality. Arsenal themselves saying that they do take their responsibilities with regard to marketing to fans very seriously. We carefully considered the communication to fans regarding our promotion and provided information regarding the financial risks. And they do go on in the statement to say that they will comply with the guidelines in this fast-moving area and they are seeking that independent review. Are we completely dismissing any sort of transformation in the relationship between fans and clubs? Fans do have to pay to be a member of the Arsenal Supporters Trust, so there is a cost in terms of that engagement. Perhaps a more regulated, better version of Sosyos is actually just more of a modern supporters group.
Well, I could call it a membership scheme, and you know, there are already membership schemes where you get more chance of an access to a cup final ticket, or you get sent a pack in the post, or you get asked your views on certain issues. And I'm all for Arsenal increasing their engagement. But if they want to do that, they can send an email out to their 180,000 existing members with a simple vote option in it, can't they? What I don't appreciate is this linking of your engagement, your support can only manifest itself through buying an unregulated cryptocurrency token. It's set up to drive you into buying a cryptocurrency. There are five different ways Arsenal could do engagement better with about an hour's work.
The other thing I was going to mention, just not about Arsenal actually, but the cryptocurrency platforms who are sponsoring other clubs in the Premier League. I mean, at least one of them has got a very sort of shadowy background and, you know, links to money laundering and organised crime. So it's very, very murky out there. The due diligence is clearly not strong enough. I mean, Sosyos at least is transparent, or at least fairly transparent and mainstream, and you can speak to them and, you know, where they are, and even, you know, the chief executive's fairly available. But, you know, some of these other ones, I mean, as we've said before in this podcast, who knows who runs them, where they're based. And we've seen with a couple of cryptocurrencies, the people behind them have just taken the cash and disappeared, and everyone who's bought it have been left empty-handed.
Arsenal have admitted they don't know what's going on, because that's why they've asked for an independent review, saying at the moment there are no guidelines. Well, come on, guys, no guidelines because it's an unregulated activity.
It's a very good point as well. This is not a sponsorship like any other, because a sponsorship will have a lifespan, whether it's on the jersey or a board or whatever, 3 to 5 years or whatever you sign, and then it's done. This thing, if it's got a 3-year lifespan, someone is still holding these coins that are floating around this exchange. That tells you everything you need to know about it, perhaps. Well, given hardly anyone votes in these polls, that's the other thing. The percentage of token holders who participate in any of these polls, you said there were 6 a year, is quite low compared to the token holders. So one assumes they're holding it for that monetary value and the arbitrage opportunity or whatever that has. And that isn't anything to do with football or fan engagement. You know, it's time to move on, really, isn't it? You know, it's time for Arsenal to get real with their fans. It's time for the other clubs too. It's just, we're having a kind of fancy dance around something that seems blatantly obvious. People are trying to make money off this coin. Yes, yes, you know.
Yeah. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, guys.
Tim Payton from the Arsenal Supporters Trust. Well, we touched earlier in the episode on Omicron concerns in Cameroon ahead of the African Cup of Nations. It is the Premier League in England particularly being impacted now by the resurgence in coronavirus cases caused by the new variant. We've just had a record number of cases amongst Premier League squads and staff in the last week or so, 90 members positive, and we've had the first Premier League vaccination details in 2 months. We know 70% of players are fully vaccinated, but 16% have had no jab at all.
One in six players not vaccinated. It's quite a lot, I think. You know, people say, oh, it's the same as the general population, but actually it's not, because the general population doesn't have the access to the specialist medical advice that the top professionals have. And I think the fact that it's, you know, some clubs have got 100%, some don't have, just it highlights it's very much a sort of club by club issue, and maybe some voices in the in those particular dressing rooms. I mean, interestingly, I found out that Watford v Burnley was called off at very short notice specifically because of unvaccinated players being in contact with a positive case in a hotel. Because they have to isolate while vaccinated players don't, that effectively called the match to be called off 2 hours before kick-off.
I mean, that's when they should be forfeiting it. I mean, if they've not been vaccinated, then it's their own fault in terms of not being able to just take daily testing to avoid isolating, really, unless they have a significant medical exemption of some sort, which means that they don't need to get jabbed. But it's certainly been one of those issues highlighted, how many games are actually off, not due to players testing positive, but actually just being deemed close contacts.
Yeah, it's deeply unsatisfying as well. And it feels unfair on those teams who have vaccinated players and are then going to either face a fixture pile-up or forced to play when they have cases that involve some of their senior players, because other teams, because they have unvaccinated players, they could have a quarter of their team out, including those unvaccinated guys who are having to quarantine. And, you know, this just speaks to like a wider society thing. Just get vaccinated if you can. It's getting quite frustrating now as well. If you look at the cases in the hospitals, the cases in intensive care, the vast majority, according to hospital doctors, are unvaccinated. It's obvious there is a link between the unvaccinated population and this virus, and with the Premier League and football more generally, it's having a starker effect, because we mentioned it last week. You have a workforce of say 20 to 25 first team players, and if a quarter of you can't function, that means your place of work seizes up. So surely there should be some onus on these guys to get vaccinated if they can. I wonder what are the stories? What are they talking about though? What is putting them off, these guys?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of stories, you know, being spread around by people. Oh, look, somebody's collapsed with a heart condition, Sergio Aguero. It must be due to the vaccination. I mean, actually, the statistics do not back that up at all. Actually, professional footballers suffering heart-related incident have been fewer since the pandemic started than beforehand. So that sort of doesn't add up. But I think you're right about forfeits. So I reckon if sooner or later, if this continues and more matches get postponed because of unvaccinated players, then the pressure will come on, and that if that is deemed to be a factor, then clubs will have to forfeit, because I don't think the Premier League can keep going as we've seen in the last few weeks.
Of course, they did decide against a pause in the season, the Premier League, but in the US, the NHL, they did decide to bring their winter break forward by a few days to pause because of the postponements caused by coronavirus cases. Also, the NFL has seen new protocols, though, brought in that after we saw various games actually having to be rescheduled. They're only now going to test symptomatic players. They're not going to be, they're going to be reducing the testing on asymptomatic and vaccinated players, which is certainly a shift in policy. Obviously, the union's particularly powerful there in the States.
There's also a cultural issue at different clubs in terms of how strict a protocol they adopt. I spoke to one of the teams and they said, despite being allowed to loosen their coronavirus protocols from Project Restart. They decided to keep them as is, and they haven't had to have games postponed. I think part of the problem is the mixed messaging, both from the government and perhaps not a hard line from the Premier League as well. It seems like it's a free-for-all, do what you like a little bit. I think if the rules were a bit more stricter and straightforward, we might have fewer of these matches being called off and a fewer cases.
And the looming challenge in tennis with the Australian Open beginning on January the 17th, Rafael Nadal testing positive this week while he was back in Spain from a tournament in Abu Dhabi. We've got the whole issue in terms of, do players have to quarantine? What will the vaccination status requirements be for the Australian Open in Melbourne in just a few weeks? And then a few weeks forward from that, the start of February, we've got the Winter Olympics starting in Beijing. We now know that there will be no hockey players from the NHL going there. In part, they're saying because of the need to catch up matches missed due to the pandemic disruption and more potential rescheduling of matches due to coronavirus cases. But lingering at the back of the mind, beyond the human rights questions that athletes are facing, is potentially if they'd have to do 3 weeks quarantine in China if they test positive.
Yeah, I mean, that's a serious risk if you're going out there. I mean, I know all the British Olympic team, they've all been vaccinated. But yeah, you know, the last thing you want is to test positive and end up in a hotel room in Beijing for 3 weeks before you can actually come home. Interestingly, the NFL are now only testing symptomatic players. I mean, I think that might be a sort of a move based on the fact that they actually don't want to find out that people are testing without symptoms, because they'll struggle to get the games on if there is a sort of so many players without symptoms but who are positive.
And that might actually reflect what many might not realise is the difference in terms of testing around the world for your average person. The US this week has only just started plans to send out free COVID-19 tests to the population. Here in England, we do benefit from being able to walk into a pharmacy and pick up a box of 7 lateral flow tests for free, or they can send them in the post, something actually listeners around the world won't necessarily have as access to as freely to test.
Yeah, that's a great point, Rob. Very good point. I mean, that's, you know, people say a lot of the reason why the UK has got such high numbers of cases is because they test just about more than just about anybody.
Well, obviously, so much uncertainty lingering over the sporting calendar as we come to the end of 2021. But we're still here at Sport Unlocked going through the holidays, keeping you all up to speed with the sports news.
Yeah, wishing everyone a great holiday wherever they are. I hope you manage to keep safe, and please get vaccinated, folks.
Yeah, great to spend some more time with you this week, guys. Have a very good secular break.
Happy holidays to everyone. And if you've got any thoughts or comments, you can message us at Sport Unlocked on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. If you've got any questions for us as we look back on the year, you can direct message them. You can also email us sportunlockedpod@gmail.com. Any big burning questions you've got over the year that's been, or the year ahead in 2022, we'll try to address them in future pods. And of course, if you hit subscribe, we'll automatically land in your feed. But for now, thank you for listening. Enjoy the sport and holidays in the days ahead.